This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. This is White Coat Black Art. In Canada, making healthcare better often seems like mission impossible.
Welcome to Castlegar. It is 11:36 a.m.
I've arrived in the Kootenay region of BC to spend time with an ER physician who is doing the impossible, saving lives while providing a kind of healthcare that just doesn't exist anywhere else in Canada. And he's done that almost by himself.
I might have known. You're all decked out.
Nice to meet you.
Brian Goldman, hi.
Yeah, this is Kevin. I just met him in the car park, actually.
Oh,
yeah,
hi there.
Yeah, I'm a local firefighter.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
just, anyways, promote the heck out of this guy. We need him national.
We do?
We need him national. We really do.
Has he saved you?
No, not myself. But, I mean, in rural areas, he's essential. Because as a firefighter, we can't get places sometimes quick enough, and he can.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay.
Can I help you?
Yes, you may.
Yes, you may.
Welcome. You're a helper. Thank you.
Yes.
Dr. Nick Sparrow is the guy who created the Kootenay Emergency Response Physicians Association, or CERPA. He greets me in a bright orange jumpsuit that screams first responder. The first clue that this fellow ER physician is unlike any of the colleagues I know.
And you're an EMS physician, which is unusual. How many of those are there in Canada?
There are plenty of ER physicians who supervise paramedics.
Maybe slightly different is that I'm on the road.
Yeah. Okay, and that's what we're here to find out all about. And this is your vehicle.
Yes, correct. This is a fully decked out EMS vehicle carrying probably about $150,000 to $200,000 worth of medical gear inside.
Paid for by who?
Paid for by the community and grants.
Not by the government.
Not by the government. The BC EHS do provide some of our medications that we use up on calls, but we've all purchased them to begin with, and all the major bits of kit, the truck, everything is all funded by grants and the public.
We'll get into that in a bit. Okay, so why don't you put my bag away?
Nick is one of few, if any, MDs in Canada who work alongside paramedics in the field.
So we've got to put our belts on.
Yep.
And I think we're heading towards Nelson. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, wonderful.
Nick and his truck have driven through much of the 76,000 square kilometers of BC's southeast corner. His base includes Castlegar and Nelson, where he and his family live. But he also attends emergencies in smaller communities like Salmo and Winlaw. He only responds to 911 emergencies. 100 cardiac arrests so far. Motor vehicle collisions, ATV rollovers, avalanches. We're on Highway 3, which runs from Hope, BC to Medicine Hat, Alberta.
You know, here we are on the road. How many kilometers do you drive a year with CERPA?
Probably 15 to 20,000 kilometers. A lot of it's local response, but we will respond up to an hour and a half in the vehicle to get to people who need help.
And you said we might go to some more dangerous areas. What did you mean by that?
It's not necessarily dangerous areas, but the calls might be dangerous. So I think in the past 10 years, which is the number of times I've been responding, we've gone to at least 19 calls that have been stabbings or shootings. Those calls potentially can be unpredictable calls where first responders may be the target or there may be violence, but you never know how unpredictable a scene can be.
You must see patients who have severe head injuries. Are you able to give them medications that we routinely use in the emergency department, like steroids and mannitol, to reduce their intracranial pressure, or is that something you would not want to do without a CT scan?
Yeah, we don't actually carry on the scene response. Really, we're focusing on stabilization, and if we need to rapid sequence intubate them and give them paralytics, etc., then that's really our main focus. It's quite difficult when you're single-handedly having to do that on scene, but you know, CERPA's responded to three individuals, all trapped in motor vehicles, all head injured, all requiring RSIs. All of them survived and all of them are back with their families and working. So I actually personally think on those individual cases, being able to RSI them almost immediately from their vehicle made a huge difference for those individuals.
And for those listening to us, RSI, rapid sequence intubation, it's a series of steps that you do to secure an airway quickly, usually involves sedating medications.
I do that in a well-staffed and well-stocked resuscitation room in the ER. Nick does it at a crash scene.
We've just actually just been paged by the ambulance service, so I'm just going to speed up a little bit, find a safe place to pull over, and then I'll make a phone call, just find out what the call is.
Okay. That's what we're here for.
Yep.
How often do you get calls these days?
I was on one today and cancelled. Most days there's calls coming through, so it can be quite busy sometimes. So this is a chest pain call, so we'll phone dispatch and just find out whether we're required on this call.
Suddenly, the interview is interrupted by an actual call. We're being careful to remove identifying details about the patient, but you get what's happening.
And we're just turning on lights. You happy?
Society takes for granted that first responders like paramedics have lights and sirens and rules that say the public must pull over. Nick says he had to cut through a lot of red tape to get the same permission for CRPA.
So how do you feel as you're heading to an emergency? Are you an adrenaline junkie?
I don't always enjoy going to calls, but I feel like, my calling in life is sometimes to be in some really chaotic situations and maybe bring some sort of peace to the storm, if you know what I mean, and just be there to help people.
I know every call is different, but I'm certainly getting a much greater sense of distance in this region compared to, say, the streets of Toronto.
Yeah.
How long does it usually take you to respond to emergencies? That's part of the issue, isn't it? That part of your usefulness.
The distances are just monumental, rural.
And at the same time, this is the realization of a dream of yours.
Yeah. I think getting out there and helping people who are really hurting, it's sort of runs in your blood.
We arrive on scene in Castlegar. 8% of the time, Nick says he's the first to arrive. But this time, a paramedic crew has arrived ahead of us. From the back of his truck, Nick grabs a huge backpack laden with equipment.
Okay, is the patient stable?
Yeah.
Okay.
Nick and I arrive at the door to the patient's apartment. He's conscious and able to answer questions, but he looks unwell and needs emergency attention. He's in no position to give informed consent to me being in the room, so I back off. While Nick and the paramedics attend to the patient, I speak with volunteer firefighters Len Coates and Russell Lundquist, who have also responded to the call. What was it like before CRPA and since CRPA? What difference does he make?
Actually, a great difference. He's an oversight for us. When he comes in, if we've got a hard patient, he's able to totally help us and work with us versus BC Ambulance having to talk to, a doctor in Vancouver or whatever. He's right here able to make those decisions with the equipment.
What are some of the things he can do that you've seen him do that you can't do and paramedics can't do?
So he is able to put intravenous in with certain medications that paramedics cannot do. He is at ultrasound as well. Being able to do some of the stuff on scene, he's able to delay or slow down the clock, shall we say, so that there's time to get the patient to the hospital. And that's a big thing in rural communities especially, right?
This is voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
He has six kids and he does this and he's married and he does ER calls. I don't know anybody that has that energy that can do all of that and keep your mind straight.
This is something you think that should be funded by the government? It should be a recognized program.
One doctor in one area. Imagine how many 100 doctors would do.
Imagine what it would be like if he stopped doing this.
Well, unfortunately, we would lose patients, and that's not a great thing.
Nick fills me in on the patient.
So we basically just did a 12-lead EKG on the patient and just had a sort of chat, did all his vitals, checked his blood sugar. Then the paramedics are able to sort of take it from here. Our role is purely supportive, so what the paramedics can do, great, and if it's out of scope, then we can help.
So not a high adrenaline call for you?
It's always nice to get out and help people, but no. Every call is important.
To patients who are saved by Nick and CRPA, the service is priceless, which makes what Nick and I talk about next all the more astonishing.
But you don't get paid to do this.
No.
But you do have to eat. You have to feed your family.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually have very stringent timeout rules as well for Kames as well. So there's a sleep criteria. You can't respond and you're timed out. So, yeah, there's times of calls coming in. More times than not, there's calls coming in and I just cannot go. Either I'm timed out, I'm tired, or I have other commitments. But still being able to, in about 10 years, answer the call to maybe like 1,300 calls. Not every one of those I've like we've responded to, but a huge number we have responded to, and maybe 25% of those calls actually intervened and done a either diagnostic or critical intervention.
Paramedics bring the patient to the ER in Castlegar. Nick and I follow behind. So when's your work done on this patient?
Once they're into the eMERGE and we've ensured that they're there safely, that the crew are happy, we'll just add a little note onto their PCR, and then we're good.
At the hospital, Nick gives his report to the triage nurse. After filling out some paperwork, we drive along the highway that runs south of Nelson to meet one of Kirpa's most successful saves.
I'm Brian.
Mirek, nice to meet you.
Mirek, nice to meet you.
Mirek Hladek is a retired climbing guide and mountaineer who owns a company that makes aluminum fences, roof racks, and privacy screens. Mirek takes me to the exact spot where he nearly lost his leg.
Yeah, so this accident happened on here on our site.
In 2022.
2022, that's correct.
So you're showing me what happened.
Okay, so we had this concrete product for siding, which goes hardy panels about 10 by 5 feet, and each of them it's about 80 pounds. And they were just leaned against the wall on a pedestal, and they were not balanced. So when I actually touched one of the panels, the whole stack happened to release and fell on me.
And you were trapped.
I was trapped right under my neck. My head was sticking out. That was the only thing. And, of course, I knew my my leg snapped right off. So my partner, June, had to get a huge pry bar to lift off that little bit of a weight. And I was able to crawl out from underneath.
With this badly damaged foot and ankle?
Well, first thought was that leg is gone. I was convinced I'm going to lose it. So on my mountain climbing and mountain biking and skiing, it was right on my mind. It was quite a bit of process, but luckily we have amazing emergency services here in Nelson. And Dr. Sparrow came up, and I asked him, Nick, what do you think? Is going to be chop-chop? And he said, no, we'll put this back together.
And that's what he told you.
He did tell me that, yeah. And basically, with assistance of ambulance, they all dragged me out from underneath there. And basically, he asked me, well, are you okay with me to do a procedure? And we're going to, you know, speed it up because we have a time frame for infections and everything else. Absolutely. I said, yeah, you my man. Let's get it done. He put me under.
He gave you medication for the pain and sedation, so you don't remember much after that.
Yeah, for pain, I mean, surprisingly, pain, I was more in shock than in pain. But as far as I know, he did full surgical procedure and managed to put the bones close enough.
Nick says Mirek's ankle was dislocated, cutting off the circulation to his foot. He figured the foot wouldn't survive a time-consuming transfer to the regional trauma center in Trail, about an hour away. So, with the help of paramedics who also attended Mirek, Nick did a surgical procedure right at the scene to put the ankle back. Crisis averted, they transferred Mirek to Trail to fix the ankle. Later, he also needed skin grafting of the injured limb.
You have a functioning ankle and foot.
I have a 90% ankle with all the motion. Hardly hurts, and I can mountain bike, I can rock climb, I can ski. I have a 20-day ski days this year, so I'm really fortunate.
Can you show me?
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like nothing happened.
Damn, that looks good.
I was really lucky. I'm lucky I'm alive. this kind of accident happen out of blue, and just have to have a good team of people to help you when that happens.
So thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah. Take care. See ya.
So how do you feel hearing about what Merrick had to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why why we do what we do. We want to help people, and to know that, like, Merrick's able to be at work and do all those kind of things is really, like, the whole basis of the charity.
CERPA has been a registered charity since 2014. It's accredited by CMAT, the Commission on Accreditation of Medical Transport Systems. It's an organization dedicated to improving the quality and safety of medical transport services. We'll be right back. You're listening to White Coat Black Art. This week, Dr. Nick Sparrow is one of Canada's only ER physicians who joins paramedics in responding to emergencies in the field. CERPA has slowly gained acceptance in the Kootenays. By signed agreement, BC Emergency Health Services works collaboratively with CERPA, as it does with search and rescue and local fire departments. As part of that, BC's emergency system notifies CERPA automatically when its services are needed. Nick says CERPA has been criticized by some paramedics for encroaching on the work of first responders. What Nick and CERPA do here in southeastern BC is common practice in places like the UK, the EU, and South Africa. In the rest of Canada, it's almost unheard of. Nick has proven he's willing to take a financial hit to do it. What he's also learning is that there's an emotional hit to being a first responder like paramedics. Have you ever rescued somebody who you know really well, like a friend?
Yeah, I've gone to friends, and I've also sadly gone to friends who have lost their kids.
Oh dear. Wow. That's the side of the job that it hits you, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and in a small town, you know everyone. Ironically, I've a track with a number of families who have lost their kids. When I say kids, if you have kids, it doesn't matter what age your kid is.
They're still your kids.
Still your kids. Yes. But tracking with those individuals is just pretty massively important.
It's the other side of the work you do.
Yeah.
Nick's passion for CERPA actually began when he was a young kid.
My little sister at age 2, we were at a Red Cross garden party, got out of her stroller and managed to find a pond and was face down in a pond in cardiac arrest, blue in the face. And actually my mum's best friend called Pat found her unresponsive and in cardiac arrest and screamed, and a Red Cross first aider who was there pulled her out, a guy called Bob Griffin, started CPR, paramedics were called, police were called, she was transported to the nearest hospital and survived with no brain damage. Maybe that stuck in my mind. There's a number of other incidents that have stuck in my mind over the years, but I'm like, if a Red Cross first aider can volunteer their time and save the life of someone, then so can an eMERGE physician be utilized to save the lives and community as well.
So what are your hours of operation?
It used to be kind of 24/7. If I wasn't working in the eMERGE, then I would go. And for a number of years, we were advocating for a larger dispatch area, and were granted it in 2022 or 2021, and our call volume increased 300%. And that meant that really, as a sort of volunteer program with the number of calls that were coming in, I had to sort of reshape like how I actually worked in the eMERGE. Like, I wasn't able to do as much because just the call volume was so much higher. And so I sort of elected to cut some of that down. And the calls that we go on are pretty intense sometimes. And that takes a bit of processing power to kind of work through those. in the midst of working in the Emerge and, you know, being married and having lots of kids. And
six of them.
Yeah, six beautiful kids. Yeah. So they kind of put up with Dad disappearing at mealtimes, and at times there is a cost, but you know, sometimes it's their friends, or it's family friends, or people that are very close, you know, to the people that we know, because it's a small town. So I think for the most part they understand, and occasionally it's maybe they don't. But my heart is not to harm my children by going on these kind of calls, but to help people.
Before I leave, Nick takes me to his place to meet his wife Krista and three of his six kids, Timothy, Jemima, and Azer.
Okay, so do you guys know what your dad does?
He's like an EMS doctor and like goes to some of the most critical like calls in the Kootenays.
Wow. How do you know all that?
He said it yesterday over a phone call.
Does he ever get called away, like, randomly?
Yes.
How often does that happen?
Quite often. And goes into, like, trail and never comes back for, like, 4 hours.
That actually is true. He actually doesn't come back for a long time, which is sad.
Yeah, one time on, like, this Christmas, he, like, had to go. So we, like, opened our stockings without him, and then we, like, waited for the presents underneath the tree.
How long did you wait?
Like, how long? Like, an hour, maybe?
I did not like waiting. I did not like it.
It was Christmas. We should have been able to just rip open all the presents.
So what does it feel like when Dad comes home after he's been doing a rescue?
Excited. Happy.
One time, like, I got this new Pokemon card, and I stayed up extra late to, like, show him that. And that was really, like, exciting.
He was telling me he came home from a rough call and wasn't quite sure he wanted to hear about the Pokemon cards, but you showed them? And how did he react?
Like, excited, I guess.
He was there. Yeah. Krista, can I get two words out of you?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you feel when he gets called away, when you're going to have dinner or something else, like life?
Yeah. It's not great timing sometimes, but I am happy that he can do it. I don't have any medical skills myself, and so, but I feel like I have a lot of compassion, and I don't like knowing that people are in need and I can't help them, but he can. So my way of helping is letting him go.
I feel like I know a bit more about what makes Nick run. What I don't know is how the story ends.
I mean, you're doing this now. If you weren't doing this, where would it be?
I mean, I think... And I can't speak to the province or other provinces in Canada, but I think in rural areas, there should be highly trained advanced life support, critical care paramedics embedded within communities. And there also should be some cross-training of physicians who are involved in EMS able to respond as a resiliency program, like across Canada.
So what needs to happen here? To get from what you do on a volunteer basis to something that's more established as in other countries, what are some of the steps that have to happen?
There's two potential steps. One, government and ministers actually say, hang on a minute, this could build resiliency for our country. EMS physicians could be trained to roll alongside paramedics, not in replacement, not at all, but to augment on major critical calls. So that may be one way. And if that's not a way that is going to happen, that some philanthropist hears this radio station and says, hey, I want to back Kerpa.
And the capital equipment and the medications are all provided, I guess the medications are provided under the umbrella of emergency services?
No, like atropine, amiodarone, some of those medications are provided through the BCEHS as part of the collaboration agreement, but everything else is purchased by Kerpa as a charity.
As a charity.
Yeah. And interestingly, because we're not a government agency, we're not allowed to use the same distribution center as other fire departments or search and rescue because we're not government. So we actually order our equipment from Alberta.
That's crazy.
And when I say that we've had challenges over the years, it's subtle things like that make it difficult when maybe it doesn't have to be, but it's okay. yeah, we did. We keep going. I'm not a quitter.
No, you're not a quitter. How much longer can you keep doing this?
Yeah, good question. It's going to be my last chapter in my book that I will do this. Yeah, we're going to train other people behind me. And if I have to keep going longer than that, then that's what I'll do. Like, if no other physicians want to step up and do it, and like it's not adopted, then like it's still not going to be in vain because we've helped a lot of people.
Well, by the same token, not many people can say they've been doing what you've been doing. So I want to thank you for inviting me here to meet you and see what CURP is all about. And I hope you're able to continue it and that you get it on some stable funding. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Brian, thank you for flying here. Yeah, and taking the time just to see what we do and care about it.
For now, CURPA is not dying. If anything, it's expanding. Nick is training an ER physician to work alongside him. He's also got a second truck ready to go, all through donations and grants. That's our show this week. If you'd like to comment, our email address is whitecoat@cbc.ca. We're on CBC Radio 1, and you can stream us live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. And of course, you can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. White Coat Black Art was produced this week by Stephanie Dubois, with help from Jennifer Warren and Samir Chabra. Stephanie also wrote a fantastic digital article about CURPA that you can find at cbc.ca/whitecoat. Our digital producer is Ruby Buiza. Our senior producer is Colleen Ross. That's medicine from my side of the gurney. I'm Brian Goldman. See you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.